Thank you for investing in your future. What you are about to hear has the power to change your life. You are about to take an incredible journey, one that will show you how to shift from fear to freedom at will. The audio series you are now listening to is the full, unabridged version of the best-selling book, Fearless Living, read by the author, yours truly, Rhonda Britton. So get ready for the ride of your life. Welcome to the world of Fearless Living. If you have ever been too threatened by failure to go for something you want, too apprehensive to share your feelings, too comfortable with your success to take a chance on making your life better, too intimidated to stand up for yourself when someone else is putting you down, too afraid that you're unlovable to end that bad relationship, too nervous about getting hurt to risk trusting another, too sensitive to criticism to speak out and be counted, too worried about losing your children's devotion to put your foot down, too faint-hearted to strike out in a new direction because you think you might not be up to the challenge, then what you are about to hear has the power to change your life. And you are far from alone. In the course of my career as a speaker and life and career coach, I have discovered that the vast majority of people, no matter how confident they appear to be, harbor paralyzing fears that lurk beneath the surface of their psyches. These inner demons are always at the ready to whisper skeptical objections and plant doubts about anything that might shake up the status quo. Do you really think you should do that? Are you ready for a big step like this? Why don't you get somebody else's opinion? Are you sure you're not getting in over your head? I mean, what will people say? These menacing messages, whether we are conscious of them or not, allow us to rationalize that we are better off not taking those chances. This does not apply to clinical emotional disorders such as depression and anxiety that require professional help. I am not advocating recklessness. I mean the virtually universal human tendency to make excuses and deny the type of fears that hold us back. Those subtle, gnawing fears that make up what I call the wheel of fear control our lives in a myriad of unseen ways. Even little incidences along the way can contribute to your fears. The time you were accidentally separated from your mother in the grocery store when you were 5 years old may have been the beginning of a fear of being abandoned. The cruel words of a childhood bully might have added to your fear that you are stupid. The criticism of a little league coach when you were doing the best you could may have made you fear that you're worthless. Fearless Living is a program that will teach you to recognize and master those fears. Mastering fear does not imply you will never experience fear again, but rather, you will know what actions to take to move beyond your fear at will, and the frequency of occurrence will diminish. As for more extreme traumas, I'm living proof that the most unspeakable of experiences can be harnessed as a force for hope. Before I went on the Oprah show to reveal at last the terrible secret you'll hear about in the introduction, I had already established my personal program of self-growth to overcome a troubled past. Alcoholism, nervous breakdowns, and suicide attempts were the misguided efforts I had previously used to deal with my fears. Yet as a result of my program, my self-destructive behavior has become a mere memory. I am astounded as I look upon my own life now. I see loving friendships, healthy family relations, a handsome income, a beautiful home, and creative fulfillment through my speaking engagements, books, videos, audio tapes, and website. Most important, my sense of self is always intact, breeding self-confidence, personal power, and clarity of purpose. In short, my life is governed by freedom. I designed Fearless Living to help you triumph over the fear that prevents you from living a fulfilling life. As of this moment, thousands, practically millions of people have attested to the life-changing payoffs acquired by following the Fearless Living program. Instead of theories and concepts, Fearless Living entails practical applications for real-life situations that will work for you. In Part 1, you will learn how your individualized fears operate, perpetuate, and manifest. In Part 2, you will discover the power behind your day-to-day actions and uncover how they sustain your fears or help you move beyond them. There's no right time to begin living fearlessly. Wherever you are is the perfect place to start. So get ready to take a journey that will transform your life. Welcome to the world of fearless living. Fear is a killer. It kills hopes. It kills dreams. It kills careers. It kills relationships. In a flash, it killed my parents. It almost killed me. How is it killing you? Introduction, my story. A steady downpour plummeted the window panes of my childhood bedroom in northern Michigan on a chilly June morning. I snuggled deeper under the warmth and comfort of my blankets, wishing I didn't have to face what lay ahead. The year was 1975, and I was 14 years old. Father's Day back then in my little hometown meant families trooping to have brunch at the local restaurants, where buffets were considered the height of elegance. Part of me was looking forward to the salad bar and the slices of roast beef, but I dreaded the get-together. My parents had been separated for almost a year, and this obligatory reunion with my father was sure to be strained. I wondered whether my two sisters, and for that matter my mother, felt as uneasy as I did. Still, I told myself nothing really upsetting was going to happen. We'd be in public after all. Everyone would be on their best behavior. In spite of all that had gone on between my parents behind closed doors, they had always been very good at putting up a front. They cared too much about what the neighbors might think. Reassured, I threw the covers off, got up, and picked out the white cotton dress my mother had finished making for me only days before. An accomplished seamstress, she took pride in outfitting her girls. I treasured everything she created, but this dress was one of my favorites. She had sewn me a long white scarf with black polka dots, an accessory that made me feel very sophisticated. I wrapped it around my neck as a kind of testimony of her love. In return, I loved her so much that it almost hurt. I have a photograph of just the two of us taken before my younger sister Linda was born. My mother was holding me on her hip. My little head was leaning on her shoulder. On the back she had written, "When you were the baby of the house, Rhonda." The image and the message gave me strength and a sense of being very special. I looked at the picture and read her words whenever the trials of teenage life started to get to me. On that Sunday morning, I had gotten dressed, and while my sisters were still fighting over the bathroom, I walked by my mother's room. She spotted me through the open door. "Oh, you look so pretty," she said with a lilt in her voice. "Come in, I want to show you something." My heart skipped a beat, because as the middle child, I cherished every moment when I was alone with my mother. She put down her omnipresent coffee mug after taking one more sip and did the rest of her makeup. I perched on the bed, careful not to rumple the spread, and watched her smooth the rouge onto her cheeks after gliding the blue shadow over her lids. Even without the help of cosmetics, she was a true beauty. I wanted to grow up to be exactly like her. "How's the new boyfriend?" she asked after she had put on her lipstick and spritzed herself with perfume. Girl talk. I was thrilled by this private, intimate moment. "Okay," I giggled. "So far, anyway. How's Bill?" Her eyes lit up. Bill was my mother's first attempt at finding love again, and my sisters and I approved. He was a big man with a heart to match, and since meeting him, my mother smiled a whole lot more. "That's what I wanted to show you," she said, dusting off her hands and reaching for something in the basket beside her. She held up a blue and red striped polo shirt. "I made it for Bill's birthday," she said. "Do you think he'll like it?" "Oh, yes, it's perfect," I said, feeling like my mother's friend and daughter all at the same time. That's when the doorbell rang, shattering the coveted one-on-one connection with my mother. "Your father's here," she said, quickly folding the polo shirt and hiding it under the bed. Neither of us wanted any evidence of Bill in the room. My father, unable to let my mother go, was wildly jealous of her relationship with Bill. "Go let your father in. I'll be right there," she continued. Her expression said the rest. "Be nice, put on a smile, give your father a hug, and keep our little secret." I stood up. After a reluctant pause, I began moving towards the front door, as my mother had asked. My father had called me a week before Father's Day, even though I hadn't spoken to him for months. He asked me to come and live with him. I had begged off. Why me? He loved Linda, my little sister, the best. Once, when I had somehow irritated him, he had chased me and pinned me down, putting his hands around my throat. My screams had brought Linda to the scene, and because of her, he had released me. Yet now he wanted me, not Linda. He said I would thank him someday. What, for the suffering? Did he think that would make me a better person? I opened the front door. The rain had slowed to a drizzle. My father stood on the stoop, a little damp, but looking absolutely wonderful and normal, exactly the way I remembered him from when I was a little girl. Pleased and relieved, I felt compelled to hug him after I ushered him inside. As he entered, my mother came towards us, shrugging into her raincoat and saying something about wanting to warm up her car. The yellow 1973 Buick Apollo was a gleaming symbol of my mother's newfound freedom. Leaving my father after 2 decades of verbal abuse had proved to be an incredibly liberating experience for her. Mom was a farm girl who had never learned to drive anything other than a tractor. Getting her driver's license and buying that Apollo had been a crucial step towards her independence. I watched, smiling, as she dashed through the raindrops with her car keys in hand. Then I glanced at my father. His eyes were following my mother, who was dodging puddles on the way to her car. Abruptly, he said, "I'll be right back. I need to get my coat from my trunk." He lopped across the lawn to his car. It was parked a couple of feet from my mother's. I opened my mouth to call to my sisters that we were just about ready to leave. Before I could utter a syllable, I saw my father pull not a coat, but a rifle from the trunk of his car. Every second that passed as I made my way from the door frame onto the edge of the porch is burned into my mind forever. My breathing stopped. My heart stopped. My father was yelling at my mother, "You made me do this!" His hand wrapped around the rifle stock, the barrel aimed straight at her. "Daddy, don't," I screamed. "Daddy, I'll live with you. Dad, I'll take care of you." Oh my God, I have to stop him. Maybe the rain was drowning out my words. Maybe he couldn't hear me. Maybe he didn't care. My desperate cries did nothing to dissuade him, his hand tightening around the trigger as he trapped my mother between the two cars. Still, I kept pleading, hoping to stop him. But my voice was powerless. Why didn't he hear me? Why didn't Linda hear me? He would listen to her. Where was she, and where was my older sister Cindy? My mother said hoarsely, "Ron, don't you do this. Don't you do this." "You made me do this," he countered. "It's all your fault. You gave me no choice. If I can't have you, no one can. No one will." While he raged, she looked him squarely in the eye, showing her courage in the face of the man who had controlled her for so long. Instinctively, she wrapped her arms around her body in the vain hope of deflecting what was to come. As I watched, I kept running scenario after scenario through my mind. I had to save her. I could jump between them. I could get between her and the gun. I could do something to distract him. Maybe throw a chair or bang on the metal garbage pail and she could run. But my body was frozen. Crack. The sound of the rifle firing tore a hole in my life. Everything moved so slowly that I felt as though I could reach out and stop the bullet in flight. The way my mother looked right before and after the bullet entered her abdomen is my most vivid memory. She was so beautiful and scared and alone. When the bullet penetrated, she fell forward ever so slightly, her body wrenched in pain, and she grabbed her stomach the way you would if you're going to throw up. And I remember her face, twisted in agony, still eye to eye with her killer. She was silently begging him to stop. And I think for one part of 1 second, my father didn't believe what he had done. I know I must have been screaming, but all I remember is the surreal silence. The click of the gun recocking broke the stillness. My father's gaze and the barrel of the gun turned my way. I was sure it was my time to die. But the gun swung back and found my mother again. And as the second bullet hit, she fell through the open door of her prized car. The bullet went straight through her and lodged in the steering wheel. The blaring of the car horn ripped into the quiet of a small-town Sunday morning. To this day, the sound of a horn has the power to unnerve me unless I call forth all the inner resources I have stockpiled to free myself from fear. The horn was still going as my father ran toward me. Rain-soaked, he fell to his knees at my feet, the gun upright at his side. He rested his right temple directly against the end of the barrel and pulled the trigger. His every moment was seamless, as if he had planned and rehearsed diligently for this final act. The sound of the gunshot at close range was deafening. My father's blood splattered on the white dress that was my mother's last gift to me. His body collapsed beside me. The only sound was my own harsh breathing, waking me up to the realization that what had happened was not a dream. It was real. I began to shudder. In that moment, I was gripped by a potent fear that I didn't deserve to be alive. Why was I still standing? After all, my father had proved that I wasn't worth living for. In fact, I wasn't even worth killing. And I, the only person on the scene, had failed as my mother's savior. What earthly use was I anyway? I turned and retreated into the house, heading for the sanctuary of my mother's bedroom where just a few minutes earlier I had felt safe and singled out for her confidences. I got down on my knees and folded my hands against the bedspread. The scent of her perfume was still in the air, and I prayed with all the faith I ever had. "Please, God," I begged, "don't let her be dead." Yet I knew even then that she was already gone. The news traveled fast through our little town. Arrangements were made, and within hours we were at my aunt's house. I am told that I was hysterical, then silent. I suppose I changed out of the blood-stained dress. I remember very little from the time I knelt to pray until hours later. I vaguely recall phoning my boyfriend and blurting out what happened, but after that everything's just blank. My aunt had convinced Cindy, my older sister, to put me on medication. I took the pill, more for their sake than for mine, but I did refuse to eat. These people, my relatives, were convinced that if I would just eat, things would be better. They had no idea. I had failed to save my mother. I didn't deserve sustenance. Every mental replay blamed me even more. In a haze of medication and self-loathing, I kept thinking I could have done something to stop my father from killing my mother. I could have stepped in front of the gun. I could have figured out something better to say. At the very least, I could have run over to the car where she lay slumped against the steering wheel. Maybe she'd been waiting for me to come to her. If I had gotten to her, maybe she would have pulled through, but I had left her there. Looking back, I know that part of the fear that was etching itself into the very essence of my being was the idea that everyone else blamed me as well. Perhaps they were even pointing the finger at me for what my father had done. After all, he had once told me that it was all my fault that my mother had left him. I had no idea what he meant, but that didn't stop me from being afraid that he was right. And yet that evening, as I did every Sunday, I went to the local indoor ice rink. Continuing with the routine I'd always known seemed like the only thing to do. I didn't get much skating in, though. Once I got to the rink, I had to take care of my friends. They had shown up not knowing what to do or say. At first, they shifted from one foot to the other and avoided my eyes. This was a pattern with which I would become all too familiar in the months and years ahead. In a world where almost nothing was unmentionable any longer, a murder-suicide, especially one involving your parents, and certainly if you were the only witness, turned out to be the last taboo. Finally, my friend Julie let herself react. She hugged me, sobbing into my shoulder. I was glad she was crying. My fear was already hard at work, keeping me from sharing my real feelings. I held her, letting her vent her grief and fury, all the while keeping mine in. I was afraid that if I let them loose, the world would not be able to withstand my heartache. I was afraid of myself, afraid to be human. The consequences were too terrible to imagine. The next day, Cindy, who at 18 had become the one in charge, left Linda and me with our aunt while she and my mother's friend Sharon went back to the house to get some of our things. Cindy told me later that when they were in the bedroom, Sharon started to cry at the sight of my mother's favorite mug on the vanity, half full of coffee, long since gone cold. I never got to see the mug. I wish I had. But no one would let me go back to the scene of the crime. They all thought they had to protect me. They meant well, but they didn't understand. After what I had seen, the damage was already done. The fear had become part of me, feeding on the ordinary fears I already had, until it was a force that dictated my every thought and every action. One minute, I had been a young girl in the cocoon of her mother's love, with my dreams stretching into a future full of possibilities. The next, I was not only an orphan, but also the person who hadn't prevented my parents' tragic deaths. I wanted to scream, "You can't keep me safe! It's too late for that!" but the fear choked me and kept the words inside. And after a while, the fear was so completely in control that I didn't even know what the words were anymore. I only knew that I must never, ever unleash them. Monday went by in a blur. My sisters say we picked out the caskets. I'll have to take their word for it. Visitation and viewing at the funeral home were on Tuesday. That I remember in exquisite detail. All afternoon, with my pen in hand and a smile on my face, I politely guided each person to the guest books, one for my father and one for my mother, and pointed out the next available space. While my sisters milled around among the mourners, I played hostess with the mostess. I remember crying very little during that time, feeling a deep obligation to tend to all these people who had so loved my mother, or my father, or both. I had to make sure they were okay. If I couldn't save my parents, at least I could do that much. After the majority of people had arrived, my sisters and I sat in the family section of the funeral home and received condolences together. When it was time for us to say our final farewell before the caskets were closed, the funeral director pulled a red velvet curtain around us for privacy. I said goodbye to my father, and I remember looking at him with amazement. There was no indication that he had shot off part of his head. I had never imagined that I would be having a conversation with myself regarding funeral directors' artistic abilities, but they should get an award, I thought. Yet if I was detached as I looked at my father's body, I was profoundly moved by the vision of my mother. It is seared into my brain. I scanned every part of her, afraid I might miss something. She wore her favorite long evergreen dress with white polka dots, the one she had bought for the first Christmas party she gave on her own after the separation. Mom had spent more money than she usually allowed. The gown had been a gift to herself, one of her small acts of freedom during her brief reprieve from a life of fear. Her hair and makeup were perfect. My mind flashed back to the Sunday morning, only a few days earlier, when I had sat on the bed watching her put on her face, as she called it. How could it be that this simple pleasure and all the rest of life's miracles would never be hers again? The funeral director reappeared, rousing me from my reverie. He took my mother's engagement and wedding rings off her hands and gave them to Cindy. Then I saw that Cindy had put her class ring on my mother's finger, and Linda had placed one of her most beloved bracelets on my mother's wrist. Both pieces of jewelry were gifts to take to the great beyond. I couldn't believe my eyes. Nobody had told me about this. I felt so betrayed, as though I had been slapped in the face, yet so ashamed that I hadn't thought of this gesture myself. Was this my sister's way of punishing me for not saving my mother? Then I stopped myself. This moment was about my mother, not me. My pain had to wait. The urgency of the situation called for immediate action. I knew that if my mother was buried without a symbol of my love, I could never forgive myself. What did I have to give her? The answer came to me quickly. My boyfriend had given me a promise ring just 2 weeks earlier, a pearl set in silver. I had been secretly longing for that ring. It was the most valuable thing I owned. I twisted the ring off and placed it on my mom's little finger. I had righted a wrong the best way I knew how. I was so angry that my sisters hadn't included me, but I also knew I could never express my shame to anyone, ever. I buried it along with my feelings of worthlessness. The funerals were on Wednesday, the day that would have been my parents' 20th wedding anniversary. I insisted on singing at their funerals. My mother had always called my voice a gift from God. She had swelled with pride when I was invited to join the senior high chorus the year I was still in 7th grade. She made sure I had lessons, and she was as thrilled as I was when my voice teacher recommended that I attend the 1975 summer session at the world-renowned Interlochen Art Center near Traverse City, Michigan. That was to have been my first time away from home, a big step toward the career that my mother was sure was my destiny. The least I could do now was to sing a memorial tribute. I picked a song called Thank You, intending to sing it at both funerals. The irony of that title for my father's funeral was lost in my denial. I truly believed I had instantly forgiven him. Even so, I did not shed a tear during his 1 p.m. service. After we laid him in the ground, We had a scant half an hour before my mother's funeral began at 3 p.m. During that brief interval, I realized which song I had to sing for her. My mother's favorite was Olivia Newton-John's hit, I Honestly Love You. I had been chosen to sing it with my friend Tammy as a duet for a choir concert earlier that year. Afterward, my mother had asked me to sing it whenever anyone stopped over. Everyone tried to talk me out of going ahead with my plan, but I was determined. I grabbed Tammy and convinced her we had to do it. She agreed. I don't know whether someone went to her house to get the music or if someone went to mine. As I said, it was a small town. We both lived within minutes of the church. In any case, we got the music and rehearsed it once in the church meeting hall. Then I took my place with my sisters outside the sanctuary, greeting family and friends. From the minute my mother's funeral began, tears streamed down every cheek and great wails of grief punctuated the proceedings. When it was my time to sing, I had to make my way from the front pew all the way back down the aisle and then up the steps to the choir loft in the rear of the church. So that I wouldn't break down, I deliberately avoided any eye contact. My aunt had begged me to take a pill before the funerals, but I had refused. I wanted to be completely myself and totally awake to my feelings. I wanted to remember everything. I didn't want to sing on drugs, I didn't want to cry on drugs, and I didn't want to see my mother for the last time on drugs. In a strong, clear soprano, while Tammy's voice harmonized with mine, I sang the song for my mother to my mother. I sang it with every ounce of my being. There is a place near the end of the lyrics where I spoke the words, "I love you," followed by a long pause. In my silence, the congregation could not contain the sobs that told of their grief and their compassion. The sounds of sadness swelled into a lamentation I can hear to this day. As I returned to my seat, all eyes were on me. Everyone was surprised I had pulled it off. But I wasn't. I had to do it. The song was the last gift I would give to my mother. It had to be perfect, and it was. Nothing after that moment was perfect for many years to come. At the cemetery, the emotional dam that had been holding back my tears finally broke. The brilliant sunlight and the fresh breeze off of Lake Superior seemed to mock the unbearable ache in my heart. I threw myself on my mother's coffin, crying, "Don't leave me, please don't leave me." My grandmother, a formidable woman with a no-nonsense philosophy of life, wrenched me off the casket and said, "That will be enough of that, it's over." As she led me away, her hand in a vice-like grip on my wrist, the fear that it was not right to be me took a firm hold over my life. The more that people tried to shield me from my pain, the more frightened I became of my own feelings, and the harder I worked at keeping them in check. Many relatives became remote. Friends disappeared. I felt totally left out. People hushed when I entered a room. I remember overhearing adults prep visitors. "Be careful not to bring up the subject of parents," they would say. I developed a sense of shame about sharing my story with anyone. I was terrified that I would be accused of not having stopped my parents' deaths. I was afraid of who I was. Much later, while attending college on scholarship, I was seen as normal, a high achiever with much to be proud of. No one would have guessed the fears that were running my life. I kept others at arm's length to avoid the fear of being discovered and to dodge the inevitable questions. Fear was my constant companion, giving me permission to lie. "How are your parents?" someone would ask. "Just fine," I'd respond. For a long time, my parents were just fine. Eventually, in the briefest of terms, I began telling people what had happened, followed by, "But I'm over that now. I've handled it. I'm fine." At the time, I had talked myself into believing that I was fine, but I wasn't. Fear was taking its toll. I was worried that I would never have enough money. I doubted my ability to succeed. I dreaded the responsibility of growing up. I was uncomfortable being alone, yet I was anxious about falling in love, because I was sure any man would discover what my father must have already known. I was worthless. My expectations regarding friendships could never be fulfilled. Intimacy and trust were elusive. Love was never part of the picture. I was easily angered and at times suicidal. Although my intellect and body had survived, my heart and soul were deeply wounded. Happiness was beyond my reach. Nothing I tried, not the therapy I sought, not the books I read, not the courses I took, not the grief groups I joined, showed me how to get beyond my fears to experience the wholeness I yearn for. More than that, I noticed that people from all walks of life had the same challenges I had. I began to wonder if maybe this is all there was. I took to rationalizing my fears away. This must be the way life is. Everyone else complains, whines, and moans. We each have our lot in life. This must be mine. I figured the best I could hope for was camaraderie through my pain. Maybe you felt the same way. Maybe you have come to the conclusion that the best you can do is learn to deal with it and try to control it the best you can. I believed that for a long time. Then I began to notice that there were individuals who did not make choices based in fear. They took risks and lived fully. When I asked them how they did it, they couldn't articulate it. They had no formula or pattern. Sometimes they were afraid, while other times they were able to move past it. With that knowledge, I became determined to help myself. I wanted to know the answer to the questions, what is fear and how does it run my life? And I wanted more than haphazard freedom. I wanted more than understanding. I wanted actual things to do that would help me get through my doubts, worries, paralysis, and defensiveness at will. I wanted to know that my fear hadn't eclipsed any good left within me. It all started with a calendar and some gold stars. Each day, I would write down exactly what I had done that was kind and loving to others, as well as myself. I was vigilant. At that point, it was all I had. At the end of the month, my calendar was covered in gold stars. I knew I had a fighting chance. From the seeds of that first exercise, I have come to realize there is a way to get beyond the fear. And it isn't always necessary to understand how your fear developed. What matters is that it did. We all have our stories, our scars, our wounds, the things that give us the excuses for why life isn't exactly as we had hoped. My story may be more dramatic than others, but the basic fear I experienced as a result of my parents' deaths is the same basic fear we all have to confront. We are afraid that, in some, if not all areas of our lives, we're not good enough. I've learned this not only because I have overcome the fear that kept my story in place, but because I have worked with countless clients who have mastered their fears as well. Of course, people don't walk into my office with the insight to say, "I'm afraid they'll find out I'm not good enough." But that's what they mean when they say, "I'm afraid my husband is going to leave me. I'm afraid I'm going to lose my job. I'm afraid I'm going to end up homeless. I'm afraid my kids aren't going to turn out well. I'm afraid I'm never going to do anything that makes a difference. I'm afraid I'm not going to live up to my parents' expectations. I'm afraid to open up my own business. I'm afraid to get involved with anyone. I'm afraid people will make fun of me. I'm afraid to speak up. I'm afraid I will never fulfill my potential." Even people who become highly successful by societal standards are not immune. Why, after all, do celebrities suffer from stage fright other than because they fear that a performance won't be good enough? As for the rest of us, just about any situation can call up that basic fear that we're not good enough. What keeps a man from asking a woman out on a date? What makes someone put off sending out resumes in order to get a better job? What makes a mother find reasons to blame herself when a child is sickly or gets a failing grade or doesn't have any friends? Why does a person who's put on a little weight come up with an excuse not to go for a checkup when that would mean stepping on a scale in front of a nurse or a doctor? There are lots of words we could use to define specific aspects of the fear of not being good enough: unlovable, inadequate, stupid, untalented, worthless, weak-willed, and loser come to mind. The label doesn't matter. Any definition that rings true for you is fine. What does matter, as I have seen over and over again with my clients, is that once people recognize the basic fear, all of the offshoot fears are rendered manageable at last. Better yet, the fear becomes not an enemy, but an ally. Instead of causing you to shy away from situations that could result in the sting of failure, the fear gives you the impetus to take on new challenges. You no longer spend your time and energy trying to avoid showing the world you're not good enough. You move to a level where you respect and love who you are. When that happens, you experience an exhilarating sense of freedom. You are no longer trapped in the false security of boredom and routine. You are released to experience life's limitless prospects fearlessly, in spite of the fact that failure is always a possibility. In the words of legendary sports writer Grantland Rice, "When the one great scorer comes to write against your name, he marks not that you won or lost, but how you played the game." Fear has been instrumental in setting your course, whether your parents are alive or dead, whether you grew up happy or sad, wealthy or poor, whether you know it or not. Fear has developed your likes and dislikes, picked your friends and raised your children. Fear has limited your potential, excluded possibilities, and controlled your choices. We can change that. What took me years to learn will take you months. I know this because so many of my clients have done it. A life worth living is attainable. I know too because I'm living it. Now is the time to begin the work that can set you free. Let's get started.